George Hoggins' new novel has been called a cross between The World According to Garp and The Simpsons. It's a novel that spans not only generations, but continents and epochs. A young white boy is born in northern Rhodesia to a couple who cast him aside. He's given, almost casually, to Howard and Julia Lament, whose own child has been stolen. Howard is an engineer with ambition, dreams, and a restless nature. Julia is both a supportive spouse in an old-style way and a restless spirit. The Laments is an ambitious, amusing, and ultimately moving story in all senses. It moves between snapshots of the last days of the old Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, the old foreign enclaves of Bahrain, the gloom of post-war Britain, the bloom of the first days of the Beatles, and finally, the first blush of suburban New Jersey, as the Laments find meaning in motion. George Hoggins joins us now from our studios in New York City. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
And I have read that this book came about because you wanted to write something to read.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I'm a roamer through bookstores, and I tend to go through, a couple of pages of each book as I'm searching around looking for something that just sort of grabs me. And then finally I thought, well, why don't you try it? Give it a shot.
The back flap informs us that you'd lived on three continents by the time you were 12. The same continents as Young Will Lament?
Yes. It's a first novel, and I really wanted to create a credible sense of background, so I used places that I knew fairly well.
You were a screenwriter in Los Angeles.
Yes.
You moved to Brooklyn at some point.
Yeah, I moved to Brooklyn in 93, and I wrote a couple more scripts, but I was struck by the fact that I had been thinking, as many screenwriters do, about how to make a million people entertained, how to amuse a lot of people, because that's what producers say to you. You walk into their offices and they say, well, pitch me an idea, you know, and then you pitch the idea, and then they say, well, you think a lot of people would really want to hear a story like that, you know, and that's quite a challenge, you know, and after doing this for many years, I got to the stage where I thought, God, I want to write something that I really care about, and I want to make it funny, and I want it to be exciting, but I also want to be moved in a way that I haven't been so far by anything else I'd done. And of course, the solution was to actually write about something that had happened to me. One of the things one does as an immigrant child is assume that no one can possibly relate to the life you've had because it's so foreign, it's so different. Mm-hmm. And I finally decided to sort of fight that mindset and actually write the novel. And that's, this is all about exactly that, you know, traveling from one culture to another and trying to fit in and the adaptive nature of a very driven family.
There's a section of the book I wanted you to read, which talks about the difficulty of being an immigrant who arrives in a different culture. In this case, the different culture is, I believe, suburban New Jersey. And I'd like you to read a section set in a classroom. Let me open my own book here.
Sure.
Section is called American History. We're talking about a character, Young Will Lament. And they inevitably, well, I don't want to prejudge anything, Young Will Lament, and they get to the period of the American Revolution. Let me get you to take it from there, Mr. Hoggins.
Will has just come from England, and here he is in America, and he's going to school. And in England, of course, the British are the heroes. And so let's go from there. When Mr. Wallace asked for an explanation of the events of 1776, Will's hand shot up. But another boy in the front row, Ernest Woodbine, caught his attention. Yes, Ernest? The British were imperialists, Mr. Wallace. Ernest spoke only to Mr. Wallace. This was probably why he was dismissed as the teacher's pet by his classmates. He was frequently afflicted with nosebleeds, and often found his bootlaces tied together when he stood up from his desk. Will nicknamed him Scabby, because his eyelashes were perpetually crusty from a case of pink eye, and he depicted him in his notebooks as a naked cretin, licking Mr. Wallace's boots. They oppressed the colonists with taxes and Scabby paused. Precipitated a conflict. The other kids also hated his big words, but this was Scabby's lucky day. He might have been a bootlicker, but he wasn't a foreigner. "Just a minute," said Will. "And, sir," Scabby continued, "they forced the colonists to stage uprisings that led to the revolution." "Yes, Will," said Mr. Wallace. "Forced them? They wouldn't pay taxes," Will argued. "Was the British army supposed to serve the colonies for nothing?" "Unfair taxes, sir," corrected the bootlicker. Taxes that paid for the soldiers who kept the peace, argued Will. An oppressive army of redcoats, Mr. Wallace, added Scabby. Americans wanted freedom, justice, liberty. Freedom? They were free, argued Will. They just didn't want to pay taxes. Suddenly, blood began pouring from Scabby's nostrils. Quickly, he reached for the massive box of tissues inside his desk, clamped a wad to his nose, and with a dramatic gulp, attempted to speak. Mr. Wallace, I don't believe my ears. Is he calling the Founding Fathers cheapskates? Until now, the class couldn't have cared less. A bluebottle fly had distracted most of the students with its drone as it looped around the fluorescent lights. But all seats creaked forward at Scabby's cry. You could almost hear a fife and drum start up in the room. Mr. Wallace cast a troubled glance at Will. I don't think we need to insult the Founding Fathers, son, he said. I wasn't insulting anyone. All I said was it was about money. It was about liberty, blubbered Scabby through a wad of crimson clotted tissue. Go back to England, shouted a wise guy in the back row.
That's a wonderful section.
Thank you.
And I must say, I think you persuaded a number of us. A refreshed perspective, to say the least. Did that ever happen, at least metaphorically, to you?
Oh, I remember stamping home in an outrage when I heard about the revolution, because I just couldn't believe my ears when I heard the British being treated as though they were the worst wretches for what they had done to America. You know, especially since the Americans ultimately wound up with America. You know, it was sort of like, well, what are you complaining about? It all worked out in the end, you know.
Yeah. There's a speech, without giving anything away, that occurs towards the end of the book when Rose, who is, I guess we can refer to her as the matriarch of the family, who has, I guess, refused to visit them in all their foreign ports of call over the years, hasn't she?
Yes, she's... It's almost her decision that if there is to be any kind of family gathering, it will be on her turf.
Rose says, America is such a crass, ugly place. I suppose one must accept its marvels with its vulgarity. It's all part of the human soup, you know. She breathed in as if the spirit were somehow lingering in the air over New York Harbor. Then she glanced curiously at Will. Are you happy here in America, Will? And I'm going to leave the answer for people who might read the book. But that speech moved me at the time it appears. It's all part of the human soup, because at that point in the book, you've experienced just about every flavor in human experience.
I think I was really thinking about America myself. I've been here since I was 11 years old, and my parents, as immigrants, immediately became very critical of everything a lot of what they saw in America. You know, one of the things that used to happen to us when we first arrived in suburban New Jersey is that we would drive down Route 1, and my mother would take us to a diner, and we'd go in, and we loved these places because they had all this American food, hamburgers and, you know, great French fries and milkshakes and stuff. And that first thing that she would do once we were inside and sitting in that booth and staring at those, you know, those glasses of water was that she would say, what's that sound? And we would all listen. And there would be the Muzak. And the Muzak would be, you know, the string version of Yesterday, or string version of Would You Like to Fly in My Beautiful Balloon, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And she would call the manager over and she would say, could we have that off? Could you turn that off, please? And the manager would say, no, we're not turning off the music. The music's for everybody, you know. And my mother would sit there steaming for the entire dinner, and we would all be in this silence because she hadn't been able to exert any control over the new world, and it was extremely frustrating. And that's where you realize the incredible rift between your parents and yourself wanting to fit in, and the realization that America is this human soup, that it has amazing cultural wonders, you know, jazz and movies and it also has television, and it also has the Partridge Family and the Lawrence Welk Show and all the things that we used to see in the afternoon on TV, and it was all part of the soup. You had to take it all.
Mr. Hagen, it's been nice talking to you.
It's a pleasure, Scott.
George Hagen speaking with us from our studios in New York. His new novel, his first novel, is called The Laments. To read another excerpt from the book, you can come to our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.